23rd. Right. Okay. Okay, so we left off last time. We were talking about selective repeat. Before I start in on that, just to remind you there's a midterm exam on Monday, right, in class. We'll do a little bit of review at the end on Friday for that. Lights. So this is sort of where we ended up. You can study this figure. The important thing to see here is that when a packet is lost, the receiver stops advancing its receive window. So the receiver has received 0 and 1 here. It did not get 2. It has now got 3. And so what it acknowledges is packet 3. Remember, selective repeat, we're acknowledging every packet separately. But the receive window stays stuck starting at packet 2 until packet 2 is finally received. At the point when that happens, the receive window advances to advances to start with packet 6. All right? And on the other hand, over in the sender, the send window stays stuck at packet 2 until packet 2 is acknowledgement is received, and when that happens, it also will advance to the appropriate point. Okay? So that's the interpretation of this set of diagrams. We ended last time by talking about how many bits of sequence number space is needed in order to support the protocol, and observed that we actually need twice as many available sequence numbers as we're ever going to use. The window, if it requires 4 bits, say, to represent the size of the window, we'll actually have to have 5 bits available in our packet format so that half of the numbers are not valid at any given time. And you can see the argument for that in the textbook. Okay, I want to move quickly on then to talk about TCP. The goal is still to finish chapter 3 by the end of Friday and get in a little review for the exam. So that's where we're headed. So TCP has evolved through a set of RFCs over the years. 2581 must already be almost 10 years old, I would think. 793, of course, was a pretty early one. So TCP is a point-to-point protocol. That means there's one sender and one receiver, right? We don't do any sort of multicast or anything. And we have byte streams going in both directions over a single TCP connection. So we will see, as we look at the structure of a TCP header, that it actually has stuff in the header to support both directions at once. And that's kind of cool. When you acknowledge something going in one direction, you can send data back as well. As we observed when we talked about the socket system calls, there are no boundaries in this data. It's just to be thought of as a continuous stream of bytes. And so when you send something, it doesn't mean necessarily that the receiver will execute one receive operation in order to get that. It may have to do several. Buffered on both ends, that's not surprising. Bidirectional. Anything else here that's... When we get to the end of the day today, we will talk about the connection-oriented aspects of TCP. The issue is that you can't just start blasting data at somebody and expect them to understand what's going on. You have to go through a connection setup phase consisting of a couple of 2.5 messages before the both parties are sort of synced up on what's going on in TCP. So that's a bit of overhead associated with TCP. And finally, flow control, which we will do today, is the process by which a receiver makes sure that a sender doesn't send too fast for it. We alluded to that before as being an issue. Okay, so a TCP segment then consists of a TCP header followed by the data being sent that's part of this stream of bytes. Remember, just like UDP, there's actually going to be a IP header wrapped around this and a link layer header wrapped around this, but we won't see those until we get into the next chapters. So from the TCP point of view, the packet has already been delivered to its destination. The thing that has to happen is that we have to figure out the source, the destination socket for it, and to do that we need to use the source port and the destination port along with the IP addresses that are in the IP header. We talked about that before, that you need that those four things in order to identify the socket destination. Okay, then we said it's a byte stream oriented, so every segment starts with a sequence number that says where in the byte stream this particular segment is supposed to live, and it counts bytes there. Be aware of that. You can send some of the bytes one way one time and one way another time. And there's an acknowledgement that is an acknowledgement of bytes going in the other direction. Okay. So this sequence number pertains to the bytes in the forward direction. This is a sequence number, but it pertains to bytes coming the other direction. It says we've got all the bytes, and we're now expecting whatever sequence number that is to be the next thing. There's a header length because the TCP actually, TCP header has some options in it, and you have to say how big those are. We're not going to talk about those. There are a number of flags in here. Unfortunately, on this slide, acknowledgement number has overwritten these single bit fields here, but we'll go through what those are. There's a bit here that says whether the acknowledgement is valid. That bit is turned off during the early phases of the connection setup, but ultimately is always on. There's these push and urgent flags, which are generally not used these days. And there are three flags, R, S, and reset, sin, and fin, that are part of the connection establishment and teardown sub-protocols. Okay. Just to help you interpret this, this is 32 bits wide. These numbers, of course, are in network byte order. There are other fields in here that are 16 bits, which you can see because they're sort of half the width of this. There's a receive window, which is how many bytes the receiver is willing to accept from the sender, and we'll talk about how that's used in congestion control. Urgent data pointer is associated with the urgent flag, so let's not worry about that. There's a checksum computed in the same way as before for UDP, and then there's the data. Okay, so all of this is one TCP segment. It will get wrapped in an IP packet, get wrapped in a network, in a link layer packet, and sent through the network and ultimately show up at the destination. Questions about that? All right. I think the key thing here is keeping straight the roles of the acknowledgement and the sequence numbers, and also understanding the receive window. Those are going to be the major issues associated with this. Okay, so here's an example of how all this goes once a connection is established. We're going to assume it's going. And this is sort of the convention that's typically used. This is used in other textbooks as well and other descriptions of TCP, so it's worth understanding how people describe this. So when we send a segment, the sent arrow will be labeled with the sequence number, which is the sequence number in this byte stream of the first byte of the packet. Okay? There will be an acknowledgement field that says, and I've received everything up to, but not including, in this case, byte number 79 of the data coming in the opposite direction, and then there will be some data and a length. So what happens when this guy responds? If he doesn't have any data to send, he sends sequence number 79, which is what was ACT here. No more data from me. He acknowledges this sequence number 42 byte by sending 43 as the acknowledgement, meaning, and now I want 43. Okay, so the invariant here is that the acknowledgement is not the last thing received. It's the next thing expected. You could make either choice, and this is the choice they made, just so you know that. He echoes back the C, so he actually sends a length of 1 here, and so the next acknowledgement is 80 rather than 79. If host B here had not echoed back the data, then this acknowledgement would have said 79 again. Okay? So, thinking back to the reliable data transfer protocols that we talked about last time, one of the things that we said was that you have to have timers in order to trigger retransmissions, right, in case packets are lost. And the question is, how do you set that timer? How do you come up with a good estimate for what that timer should be? Think about it. You send data, and what you're waiting for is an acknowledgement of that data. That can't happen any sooner than what is the so-called round trip time, the time it takes for the data to get there and the acknowledgement to come back. That's the round trip time. So we definitely want to have a timeout that is longer than the round trip time. But in practical networking situations, the round trip time is something that varies with time. It can vary on every packet. It can be different on every packet. So what we've got to come up with is a way to establish the round trip time that works correctly and hopefully also works efficiently. And so TCP has come up, the designers of TCP over the years have come up with a scheme for doing that. So we want longer than the round trip time. If it's too short, we get premature timeouts, and that causes unnecessary retransmissions. But if it's too long, then what happens is the whole communication process stalls waiting for the timeout to happen. And there's nothing more frustrating than something that runs slowly with nothing going on. You know, that just drives me nuts. It happens in programs, it happens in networking. So you want to get a good estimate of the round trip time. How do they do it? Well, they measure it for each packet that is sent. You get back an acknowledgement, and you say, all right, how long did that take? That's an estimate of the round trip time. But because it varies a lot, we want to actually average that over a period of time to get a sort of more a smoother version of the round trip time. Okay? So the formula for that is so-called an exponential weighted moving average. And it's parameterized by this number alpha. It says we multiply the previous estimate of the round trip time by 1 minus alpha, and the current measurement by alpha. Okay? And if you think about this, the effect of this, if you write down a bunch of these, what you see is that the old measurements sort of fade away at an exponential rate in this average. Have you encountered exponential moving averages before? Well, let's do this. Suppose now we're back to, I can't write. What I write is appearing in a different place than where I write it. Brilliant. Okay? Still not working. I had it working so well, and then the battery died, and haven't got it working again right. Okay. Let's do this then. I have another trick up my sleeve. So T0 equals 4, T1 equals 6, T2 equals 8, T3 equals 6, T4 equals, I don't know, 2. And so initially we have that the RTT is equal to 4, and then after we get the next message, we take, and it said, let's see, it said use alpha of 1/8. So 1 minus alpha. So we take 7/8 times 4 plus 1/8 times 6 as the, this is RTC. 2 and whatever that is, I don't know. 28/8 and 6/8 is about 4.5. Okay? And so then RTT2 comes about by taking 7/8 times 4.5 plus 1/8 times 8. Okay? And go on and on. And if you sort of write this out as seeing what the contribution of each of these numbers is, you see that it's going down as an exponential, as a geometric series, that is, exponentially. Okay? So the influence of T0 sort of rapidly disappears, and the influence of the later numbers comes to dominate. And that's what you want to have happen. Okay, so you can implement that and graph it, and you see that the blue numbers here are the individual measurements, and the pink line is the much smoother estimated round trip time. So the way to set the timeout then is to take your estimated round trip time and add a safety margin, right? Because you know that the estimated, you know from looking at this graph, you know that a substantial part of the time the packets are going to take longer than the round trip time. So you don't want to set the timeout to be the round trip time, the estimated round trip time. Because you'll get a lot of timeouts. So you want a safety margin. And how much safety margin that you want is in the TCP standard based on essentially the deviation of the round trip time. Of the round trip time. That is how much it isn't smooth. Right? So if it varies a whole lot, you also estimate that again with a exponential moving average, and then add 4 times that estimated deviation to the round trip time to get your safety margin. So exponential moving averages are important in both of these measurements. Notice the use of the absolute value here. You don't care whether it's any particular measurement is higher or lower than the previous round trip time. You just want an estimate of how much it differs from the previous round trip time. Okay? Questions about that? Okay, so then, so we did the segment structure and the timeouts. Reliable data transfer then is an application of what we talked about last time. TCP uses a combination of the two techniques we talked about last time, which were for reliable data transfer, which were pardon? Selective acts was one, and go back in. Okay, go back in. All right. So the basic design of TCP is go back in, but they've added some hacks that give it some of the characteristics of selective acts. So for now, we're going to talk through how all this works without flow control, congestion control, or duplicate acts. And let's see what happens. For sending, it's very much like what we talked about for go back in, except now we're sort of keeping track of things in terms of byte positions instead of packet positions. Okay, so instead of counting packets, we're always counting bytes here. So when we're trying to send data, we create a segment with the correct sequence number, and we start a timer if we haven't already started a timer. We may already have one running because we may already have outstanding data. So the single timer is associated with the oldest outstanding data. And the timeout interval is determined by that calculation we just talked about. If a timeout occurs, we retransmit the oldest segment and restart the timer. And when we receive an acknowledgement, we update the set of things that we know still waiting to be act, and we may have to restart a timer as well if that happens. Gosh, that air conditioning is noisy today. I feel like I'm having to yell to get over it. Are you hearing okay in the back? Okay, all right. I'll keep yelling. So, like I said last time, these state machines now are much better described as code, where we identify the events as being things like data received in order to send it out, timeouts, and acknowledgments received, and we say what happens in each of those cases. All right. So this is, I think, much clearer presentation. But the code just really says what I said on the previous slide. So what happens when an acknowledgement is lost? Okay, we tried to send something at position 92 and it had 8 bytes. The receiver acknowledges 100. When that happens, the acknowledgement is lost. After the timeout, we resend it and hopefully get back the acknowledgement that time. Right, so that's a straightforward case. A little bit less straightforward is what happens if the timeout happens prematurely. That is, the acknowledgement was not lost, but actually shows up after the timeout occurred. We resend the data associated with that and get back then an acknowledgement of everything that the receiver has received up to that point. Okay, so that triggers not an acknowledgement of 100, but an acknowledgement of 120. Okay, so what makes a good exam problem? A diagram like this with events on it and various numbers left out. All right, and I ask you, what should those numbers be? That makes a good exam problem. Hint. That's interesting. Other things that can happen. Suppose this acknowledgement is lost, but the sender has gone ahead and sent some more data that in turn has produced an acknowledgement for that later data. Well, by acknowledging the later data, the receiver is acknowledging the earlier data as well. So when the timeout here could happen, it doesn't because this acknowledgement has canceled it. Right? Okay. So, let's see. So there are a bunch of rules in the RFCs about what is supposed to happen at the receiver when various different things occur. And this is where TCP takes on a little bit of the flavor of selective acknowledgments. Okay? And it does it by, let's see how it does it. This is the normal case. A segment that's the next expected segment arrives, everything's there, everything's good. The receiver action in that case is actually not to acknowledge immediately, but to wait a while. That's just to cut down on traffic, the idea there. It waits a while, and if that while passes, then it will send an ACK for that. But the other normal case is that while we're in this state of delaying an ACK, we get another packet. At that case, we send an ACK for both of those packets. A single ACK that takes care of both of those packets. Okay? So this is the sort of normal case. If we get a segment that's sort of beyond the place that we're expecting, well, what does that mean? That means that some packet has probably been lost. And the sort of new thing in TCP there is to say, well, when that happens, let's resend the ACK with the point that we've actually got to. Okay? So when we do that, we'll see on the next page how the sender responds to that. But that's the sort of selective ACK behavior that I'm talking about. And here we send an ACK. If we're filling in a gap at the receiver, we go ahead and acknowledge that as soon as it happens. What happens on the sender is I just can't make marks where I want to make them here. Concentrate on this box, okay, where we send an ACK for something we didn't just receive, but something that we got earlier. That is going to trigger this behavior on the sender. We get an ACK back for something that we already saw an ACK for. Okay, let's think about what that means. We got an ACK back for something that we already saw an ACK for. That means that the receiver has received something sort of farther down the road with a gap in between. And so So what happens then is that if that happens a bunch, the sender says, okay, that really means that something's lost. And it, without waiting for the timeout, it just goes ahead and retransmits the packet that it's getting those duplicate acts for. Okay? And it just retransmits that packet. Okay? Doesn't retransmit the whole string of things after that. So by retransmitting that packet, then hopefully what happens is the receiver got all those later packets. When it gets this one, that will fill in its gap. It will acknowledge the whole string, and we'll be back in a high performance situation again. Okay? So that's kind of a tweak on the go back N versus individual per segment acknowledgments. One of the options that you can set now, according to the later RFCs, is you can actually do per packet acknowledgments in TCP with and that's negotiated using those option fields that we didn't talk about. That's pretty important on really high performance, high bandwidth, long delay links, because you've got so much data in flight that you don't want to lose any of it. Anything that was successfully delivered, you want to make good use of rather than throwing it away and having to retransmit. So this helps a bit, but it isn't as good as a full-blown selective ACK scheme. Okay, so this is just an illustration of this of this story. Here's the data, here's the ACK, here's data that got dropped. Here are three more data packets that were sent. As soon as the third one of these arrives, we resend this one, which then completes everything up to this point, and we go on. That's an illustration of that. And here's the code for that in a little more detail. You can study that, but you know, with the understanding of the previous slides, this should be obvious. Yeah. Yeah.
So on that last diagram you showed, when it resets that second one,
yeah,
immediately after that, is it just waiting to see the second one, or does it continue on at the same time?
It can actually continue on if there is more room in the window. Now, the behavior here suggests that either the application ran out of data, right? It stopped sending here. So either the application ran out of data or it had filled up the window. If it filled up the window, it won't send anymore. If the application happens to have more data, it could go on. Yeah. That's the reason it stopped. Good. Excellent question. Yes?
Well, those people usually try sending the third segment right after the second.
Again. Here?
Yeah.
No.
It
because it was a fast retransmit triggered by these acts, it just resends this one. Okay? Now, however, the timeout happens, then we'll be in the regime where we actually resend everything. But hopefully that will all happen in good order. Because notice that after we do this, we should get back I think we reset the timeout at this point as well. So we should get back an acknowledgement that takes care of all of these in a timely way. Okay, so this is the retransmission story, the reliable data transport story. The other problem that we have to worry about with byte stream is flow control. How do we avoid having the sender send so much? I alluded to this, remember, way back at the beginning. How do we avoid having the sender send so much data that the receiver just has to drop it because it has no space for it? This was a much bigger problem, when TCP was built than it is these days. Usually you don't have to worry about this, but the protocol still goes through the whole dance associated with it. So the idea is the receiver side has a receive buffer. It fills up, this is a strange diagram, it fills up from this end. So there's data in the buffer. And what keeps the data from going out of the buffer? Well, the speed at which the application process is running that's taking the data out of the buffer. If the buffer fills up, then any incoming data has to be thrown away. So at any given time, there's some amount of this buffer that's available to hold incoming data. Okay? And if you think about this sort of in the long term, what's going on here is that we're sort of ultimately slowing down the sending application to the rate at which the receiving application can consume the data. And through all the mechanisms of the network, over the TCP connection and all that, we ultimately have to slow down the sender. Okay, so there's a formula for the size of the receive window. It's basically how much data is in the buffer, how big the buffer is minus the amount of space that is consumed by the data that's sitting in the buffer. Every TCP segment has one of those fields in it called receive window that says how much data the receiver is willing to take. And the sender is required to obey that, right? If it has sent a certain amount of unacknowledged data, it must not exceed the amount that was so-called advertised in the receive window field coming back from the receiver. Okay, just as a couple of observations on that, that's a 16-bit field in the TCP header, the receive window. Okay, so how many bytes big can a receive window be? This needs to be second nature information for computer scientists. How many? If the receive window size is represented in a 16-bit number, how many bytes can it be? Two? Nice. All right. 16 bits represents numbers up to 64K, right? So, with a 16-bit receive window size, you can say, I can take up to 64K bytes of data. Well, remember those calculations we did early on about how many, I guess we did them in the homework, how big is a bit on the wire? How long is it? What is its length in meters? And if you think about it, as the transmission rate, R, in our formulas, gets to be sort of large, like gigabits per second, those bits get to be very small in length. And if you think more than about what we said last time about needing to fill up the wire in order to have high utilization, well, what happens if we have a very long wire with very short bits? Then we need to have a whole lot of bits to fill up the wire, right, in order to have good utilization. And it turns out for modern networks, 64K bytes is just not big enough to let us fully use the available capabilities of a network link. So another one of those options that you can say during TCP setup negotiation is called window scaling. That lets us specify that instead of bytes, the window size is expressed in larger units. So you could say, instead of 64K bytes, you might say 64K 1 kilobyte chunks. All right? So you could have up to 64 megabytes of window size. Okay? So that's a recent thing that had to be added to TCP. TCP had to evolve to be able to do that. Because networks got faster, and in order to use faster networks, you had to be able to fill them up. Fill up the wires with bits. All right. So, last thing to talk about today is connection management. We said we had to sort of initialize a connection before we could use it. And we actually have to tear it down when we're done with it. So before we can get going, we have to agree on initial sequence numbers. It turns out that for sort of reliability and somewhat security reasons, the TCP sequence numbers are started with random values in both directions. Right? So we pick some number and say, that's the number associated with the first byte that I'm going to send. That's the sequence number associated with the first byte I'm going to send. Works perfectly well. It's sort of an arbitrary number, so who cares? That's fine. We don't always start at zero. But we have to agree on that for both directions. And we have to get the receive windows in both directions before we can really get started sending data. So the dance is associated with the connect and accept operations. The server is sitting there waiting for an accept. The client sends a TCP packet with the SYN flag set. Remember the S flag back there in the packet format. It says what the sequence number is. The server replies with an acknowledgement of that SYN and specifies its initial sequence number and receive window. And then the client can acknowledge that in turn and set its receive window, and then we're off and running. Okay? So it's at this point that we can send data for the first time with the third packet. Quickly, closing goes similarly. The client, say, either end can actually start the closing process, but assume it's the client. He says thin, that's setting the F bit in the packet that we had before. The server acknowledges that and sends its own thin sometime later. at that time or sometimes later, and the client ultimately acknowledges that, and then things go away. There are tricky little things associated with what happens if the acts are delayed. In that case, we actually keep this connection around for a while so that we don't reuse the port numbers and get confused about which connection a segment belongs to. Right? That's the purpose of this timed wait at the end of closing. It says, you know, until we're sure that there are no more packets out there in the network associated with this connection, we don't want to start another one that could be confused with this one. So that's the main trickiness there. All right, and this, of course, is described by state machines. You can see them in the book, but pretty straightforward. Okay, so next time we will quickly go over congestion control. What we talked about today was flow control, that is, making sure that the sender behaves properly with respect to the receiver. Right? We don't want the sender to overrun the receiver. Congestion control is associated with how do we make the sender behave properly with respect to the network itself. How do we keep the sender from overloading the capabilities of the network? And that's... Unfortunately, the capabilities of the network depend on who else is playing on the network at the time, right? So there needs to be some sort of scheme that uses feedback from what the network is experiencing to control every sender. And that's what congestion control is all about. This is some of the most fun stuff there is. So, good things. We'll see you Friday.